August 12th, and this is a forum with Bill Strelo, who's speaking, Karen Bloomquist, and John Schramm. Subject generally titled, Our Transitions, Our Church, and Our Society. And Tate Ministry, if you can begin, please do so. And just one editorial comment, but it certainly was an interesting worship service.
Why don't you ask how many liked it?
Pardon?
Why don't you ask how many liked it?
Okay, how many liked it? How many disliked it? How many are in between? Good. And thank you for asking to ask that question. I was chasing our son. And other people were chasing something else out there as they lived. But to their credit, they went and they talked about their feelings, which I hope we can do here tonight and in ensuing evenings together. Because as I walk around the village, I see and I hear and I actually feel things bubbling up. And I don't want to let those bubbling ups, those questions, those feelings, those hearings just disappear. Because they're important questions, they're important feelings. They come from deep inside each and every one of us. They arise because of the circumstances in which we live, and in and around the circumstances which have shaped us as people over the years that have in fact brought us to this place. And so I don't want to let them disappear. And that's one of the reasons for the comments about the worship service. Last night, and I want to emphasize the night, the evening hours, when the sun goes down and the moon comes out and we can settle into a more cozy, almost claustrophobic community for me.
But it's still the real world, right?
But the real world. A real world in which I can see stars. I live in Chicago, and I can't see stars. And if they would get the jacuzzi repaired, it'd be a heck of a better world. But we talked about the media and its impact on our lives and the shaping effect that the media, both broadcast and print media, have. And of course, also the conversations that people have around what the media presents to us as having shaping effect on our lives. And for some of us, the media impacts the very way we live and indeed the way we sleep. I'm used to watching Ted Koppel on ABC's Nightline. And after I watch that show, there are many nights where I get very little sleep. It jars me into thinking about the various items, various analyses that are presented on that show. It jars me with a changing world before I go to sleep. And then, of course, I remember that more often than not, insurance companies buy time on the broadcast media very late at night, wanting to know if I have enough insurance. Will your wife and son be protected? What about your house? And I go to sleep. Pardon?
It's
because it's cheap then, but it takes hours of sleep for me. And for a time, perhaps you'll remember, they're not so frequent now, but there used to be commercials about Nitol and Somanex. They haven't advertised Valium, but I'm sure that's coming. Making us aware of aids that help us sleep at night, or from the drugs, aids to help us make it through those waking hours. And so the media addresses, promotes, or dances with what I want to call a restless society. You may want to have other words that you would apply to it. But a restless, changing society, and as someone said at the bulletin board out there, so what's new? The society's always changing. But a society, if you will, that is in a very pivotal transition. It's moving from one set of values to others, or it's mixing values as we come to grips with what it means to be a pluralistic society, a society that's in tension. And then we come here as people of God, people of the church, and we come as members of a church which preaches and proclaims the love of God, but also preaches diversity in the church, inclusivity in the church, pluralism in the church. And folks, I think, begin to feel, or at least are aware of, the differences that the diversity that we talk about in the church or in society brings to us. We talk about a new Lutheran church, a church for all God's people. And we say yes to that, or we say no to that. In a few weeks, each of the churches is going to be meeting in convention, and they'll be talking about quotas. Say yes, or we'll say no to that, as we deal with the issues of diversity, inclusivity, and pluralism. Having said all this, then, what I do is I remember the Nicodemus story, and that's why I asked at least some of you. I dozed off during the first setting of dinner tonight, so you didn't have your instructions, at least those who ate them, to recall, if you would, the Nicodemus story. Because I like to think of that as the Nicodemus syndrome. And for a minute, I'd like to play with the text. You know, Nicodemus is a ruler of the Jewish people, and he has some trouble sleeping at night. He's a lover of God. He's a lover of God's ways. He's a thorough student of the law. He's in a pivotal leadership position. He understands God's ways, or at least he thinks he understands God's ways. As a person, though, he feels his world, and the emphasis is intentional, he feels his world being threatened. He feels his world is changing. It's going through some sort of transition. You'll remember that he's an urban dweller. He's in Jerusalem, and there are riots in the streets. We would say there are terrorists in the streets. And he recalls just recently the terror that took place in the temple when a certain religious person came in and overturned the tables. What he believed about himself, about his past, about his present, and indeed about his future was being questioned publicly on the streets in Jerusalem and in the surrounding countryside. And he was being challenged by religious folk, by secular folk. Indeed, he was being challenged by an itinerant rabbi that you and I have come to know, or at least know about, as Jesus. And so by night, he goes to the source of his restlessness. He goes to the one he heard about. He goes to the one that we know, or at least know about, as Jesus. And he simply says, "What do I do?" And of course, you know the story. It's been debated. You're born again. Oh, I can't be born again. Am I condemned? No, you're not condemned before God loves you. I do not come to condemn your world. I come to free your world. Your world may be perishing as you see it. It may be changing, going through transition. But if you believe in what God is, you will have eternal life. You will have a life of power. So look at Nicodemus and then look at yourself. And perhaps you have restless nights or restless days, questioning days about the world that you live in, about the values that you are brought up with being questioned. I mean, Dan Spencer was here today. His lifestyle when I was a young person, and I'm 44, but when I was young, was seriously questioned. I moved to San Francisco, and my father said, "Be careful. But I came to realize in that mood that I was loved and cared for by the homosexual and lesbian community. My values, my Midwestern values, were questioned. I was going through transition. For you, some of the transitions we go through as Americans, white upper middle class Americans, to the left of center, in the center, or to the right of center politically, are painful. And for some, as you witnessed and heard tonight, the church adds to that pain. Think of those folks who left in a huff. Think about some of the huffs you felt, I felt, and I find myself falling to the left of center. Because in a worship service, a different message, a different gospel, or a different edge of the gospel was proclaimed. Church and politics, the church as a mediating structure in society. What might that mean? What might that mean for us to live a new life? So we've asked Karen and John tonight to be the source of some of our discontent. And so we ask a question: what might a new life, what might being born anew mean for persons, not the average American, but the American who has average experiences, who turns on the broadcast media and is confronted or assaulted by what she or he sees? What might be the consequences of hearing a different edge of the gospel within a changing society? Not simply as an individual, as John reminded us yesterday in Robert Bellah's book, Habits of the Heart. What would it mean for us to break some of those habits of individualism? You know as well as I do, you go to any bookstore in any part of the country, including Golden Village, and the shelves abound with self-help books. Season is in the man's life for men, and there's counter books for women. But what might the church have to say about the changes within itself? The church in the world, as John was talking about. What are the consequences for you and for me in the way you step into bed at night, hopefully sleep, and the way you put your foot out of bed in the morning? So we want to ask Karen first and then John, what advice would you give to the restless sleeper?
John.
Be he three or be he... to help us through these changing times. And then after they talk, you all can jump in.
I'm very strongly committed to forums being open discussion. This seems to me this is the time today where it should be your talking. So I will start it very briefly. I do think we're living in that kind of time. Enough changes of cultural assumptions that we probably feel it down here. There have been changes in the cultural assumptions where everyone had agreed. In other words, you had Democrats, Republicans, and you had socialists and capitalists, and you had labor and management disagreeing, but there were some basic cultural assumptions that were kind of the firm rock on which it was good to have this debate up there, because there was a kind of base that held, and I think that base is shaky, and that we feel that. So in a biblical image, it's the same question that the church had when Jerusalem fell. When the center of the world is gone, what do you do? That may be overly dramatic, but I think that's maybe one of the reasons that we don't sleep. Whether that's the nuclear age, whether it's that we feel things are out of control, whether it's when I grew up, it seemed to me that there were problems to solve, and we now have, they've even invented a word, problematique, where the cluster of problems is such that it's a mystery to be lived, not a problem to be solved, because if you work on one, it aggravates another. I'm sure you've been, had some of the experience of not having confidence that put enough technicians and problem solvers on it and we can solve it. E.F. Schumacher used to say, we've increased the number of problem solvers, but we have not solved the problem. So I do think it's that kind of time. I'm going to take the tack, and this kind of goes to the relationship of church and world. I'm going to take the tack. My hope is that the church is present in the world the way Jesus was present in the world. Now, that certainly does not solve all the practical questions, but for me, that's a starting point. And we do have some clues as to how Jesus was present in the world, or his understanding of the relationship of church, the called out ones, and the culture or the state in which those called out ones lived. And I want to push for that being the primary task. Another way to say that is that my primary interest is for the church to be the church. That puts me sometimes in a camp of some people who've been saying, we've been saying that all along, that our agenda is prayer, not social action, Trim. I'm glad you finally came around. And that's not where I am, but it seems to me that that agenda is not forsaking the world. It does have some of the biblical images of being light, or leaven, or salt, very much part of the world, but a distinctive, called out people who live an alternative way, even an alternative society, not for the sake of being an esoteric little group that enjoys one another, but precisely for being that first fruits, or that evidence of an alternative way to a world nearly hardened with violence. So my interest is for us somehow to be that alternative to the reasons that people can't sleep tonight. One way you could say that is when Jesus came, there were a lot of answers to the relationship between church and world. Some of the answers had names to the particular group of people. I think of Essenes, Zealots, Pharisees, Herodians, there's four, and it's not hard to describe them. I don't mean to make a lecture out of it. Essene said you fled from the thing. You founded enough Holden villages that we could all go there and just stay away from the world. Zealots were a kind of liberation army that with guerrilla warfare thought that you killed Roman soldiers whenever you could, and you took over with the use of force. Kind of an underground movement that espoused violence. Pharisees had their own way of running. They didn't go to a desert, but they, in essence, this is oversimplification, they did, in essence, said, give us our prayer book and our rituals and let us worship, okay, and we won't say much about what the structures are around us. If we can have our purity, give me the LBW and the unaltered Augsburg Confession, and I don't care what my government is like. And the Herodians had the highest art of the compromise. I guess Sadducees and Herodians are in the same kind of camp. The art of the compromise. Make the best of a bad situation. Chaplaincy to bad institutions. Bring the best you can, because it's a fallen world. And as I read the New Testament, Jesus said, none of the above. And so it isn't, when I say let the church be the church, that I'm going back to some Essene or Pharisee withdrawal. I'm saying what interests me is to find a way in which we live out an alternative for the sake of the whole world, live out an alternative. And I'll give you one example out of, I guess, many that there could be, and that would be Koinonia Farms near Plain in Georgia. Clarence Jordan was confronted with a segregated, if not by law, apartheid-type law, at least a reality of a segregated world. He did not spend his time picketing the state capitol. He did not spend his time rewriting the Constitution. And he did not spend his time designing new wineskins. He created Koinonia Farms, which was new wine, which was against the grain and probably against the law, or at least the custom, an integrated community that lived out a dream of all people being able to live together in the midst of a segregated world. And it seems to me that that new wine does burst wineskins. That doesn't mean I don't have any interest in those who write the law, but I have more interest in Koinonia Farms that by their very existence say something new is coming, and the old wineskins will not hold the wine. And I think rather than being interested in getting born-again Christians to be at the very heart of our worldly institutions, first of all, that's a naive assumption on how easy it is to change those institutions. The Pentagon has the largest library on nonviolence in the world. They've read all of it. They can outdo me on a knowledge of nonviolence. And for me to think that I can enter that system and make it be nonviolence is an insult to that system. It's just, I'm not interested in trying to do that. I am interested in being part of a group that has a different assumption about how you respond to violence in the world. I think that's plenty as a start. I'll switch to you.
Anybody like to respond to John before Karen, or would like her to say something and respond to both? I think so.
I think when this evening was planned, the assumption was that John and I would somehow come out on either or sides of this issue. And I one of the things I would want to say is that what I'm going to suggest is not at all an either or kind of thing, because my way of coming at this question is one that very much appreciates and sees the necessity for small disciplined communities living out these alternative value systems. My question is whether, in fact, that is adequate to see that as the primary or the sole response. That, I'm not suggesting that John is posing it as the sole one. But before he spoke at 7, I had jotted down the following phrase, which indicates that maybe we aren't as far apart as some of the other things that I've been saying might indicate at times. Is that for me, the primary task, and this is actually, I think, comes from some of the words of Walter Brueggemann, who talks about it in terms of a prophetic imagination, which, as John was talking about contemplation this evening, I was struck with how similar those two are. The primary task for me is that of how we nurture or nourish or evoke a consciousness and perception that is alternative to the consciousness and perception of the dominant social order or worldview. Or to put biblical words on that, it is the way of Jesus. And what does it mean to live that way and to think that way, to have that kind of consciousness and perception pervade what we're about? One of the things that I've been really intent on trying to do, at least in the teaching that I do around the seminary, is try to unpack what that means in the lives of our typical Lutheran congregations, because I'm aware that it's very easy for our students at times to say, oh, well, yeah, that's really what I want to be about, you know, but then all of a sudden, you know, how they connect that with where folks in a local congregation are at is usually such a frustrating experience that many just kind of throw up their hand and say, oh, I'm not going to the parish ministry, or else they say, well, you know, I'm going to go out in that congregation and therefore I'm going to give up on trying to engender any kind of alternative consciousness. It's kind of a, you know, either an extreme idealism on the other side or an extreme, on one side, or an extreme defeatism on the other. So that increasingly what I think the challenge is one of trying to discover how the seeds for that alternative consciousness and perception of what's going on in our world is already lodged in what people are experiencing in their own lives. And therefore, I think a part of the agenda is not necessarily beginning with a kind of self-sacrificing, only concerned for the other kind of sense, but taking very seriously people's own self-interest. You know, what are the particular pains, the particular pressures, the particular incongruities that people are experiencing in their own lives? And how can we help to unpack that and understand some of that theologically? And I think that means that a central task of the church when it thinks of trying to relate to the world is taking seriously how persons' lives are microcosms of all those tensions that are going on in the world. And how do we help one another understand all of those pressures and tensions out there as they come down into the very real tensions that one is experiencing day in and day out, and living as we do in a society and oftentimes in a church where we're preconditioned to live under the pretense that, well, everything is basically all right. Well, so that the contradictions and the disappointed yearnings and hopes usually aren't brought to the surface. But how can the church be that kind of community that enables some of that naming to go on? This is obviously somewhat related to some of the stuff I was going through in my session earlier today. But I think that is one of the key places where we can begin to enable one another to name some of the contradictions and to discover some of the glimpses of God's transforming grace from out of the matrix of our own lives, all of those forces and pressures that are conditioning us. So that it's not simply a matter of saying, well, there's all these threatening agendas that are being imported from all these other places. But no, we're talking about forces of transition that in all kinds of ways are impacting our own lives. And yet, so oftentimes, we've kind of put a veneer over that and said, well, you know, we really don't want to admit that or begin to talk about that. And so therefore, I think what we discover is that manifestations and our awareness of the spiritual crisis or the transition crisis, the Nicodemus kind of crisis, emerges in the midst of our living with those powers and those principalities. And therefore, I think it's in the midst of all of those tensions that there can be the real spiritual awakening, the very earthly, historical, social kind of spiritual kind of stuff that John was talking about yesterday. And I think it's there, in the midst of all of that stuff, and in the midst of all of those tensions, and in the midst of all the turmoil that Nicodemus was experiencing, that we discover in some new ways what radical conversion to God really is all about. And it's at that point, then, that I think we really need, as communities of faith, to grapple far more boldly than we often have with that key question. You know, at what point does non-compliance with the social order, you know, does somehow stepping back from the kind of job that I'm working with or the kind of community that I'm involved in, at what point does non-compliance with all of that become necessary and possible? Now, we might be able to say, at one point, well, yeah, it's necessary that we not go along with the way in which this business or this corporation or this military or whatever does its business. But I think the other part of this and some of the, especially Hauerwas and Yoder kinds of readings that we've done in the ethics courses that I taught at the seminary, the question that students always say is, okay, then how do I equip my parishioners to live this out? And we look around, they look around and they say, hey, you know, that may be a necessary stance of non-compliance, but what is it that's going to really make that possible? Well, it's at that point that I would want to suggest that there's some incredible power of the Spirit that we often have not realized as fully as we might. But I think that spirit as it comes through the bonds of that community of faith. And so to me, the real challenge is, can our communities of faith be that strongly supportive of one another so that when people do feel that need to enter into a posture of non-compliance, they're not just out there on the limb? Because I think in more cases than not, we find that, well, yeah, it's nice talk, but you know, what's going to happen to someone if they take that risky step with all of the kinds of risks and things that are likely to be jeopardized in the process? So I think that's the question we need to grapple with. Now, you know, what is faithful, and how are we going to support one another in being what is faithful? And at what points don't we have that support? And therefore, yeah, maybe we are going to live in some compromising kinds of situations, but how do we move beyond simply being in that compromising situation and just, you know, throwing up our hands and saying, well, it's all ambiguous, we've got to live with it. And it's at this point where I think there's a lot of remnants of, you know, two kingdoms theology, et cetera, that's beset Lutherans that I think we need to, you know, becomes very unhelpful in terms of keeping us from making these risky kinds of moves.
I'll begin by asking a question which is not directed to Karen or John, but directed to all of us. Are they making any sense to you? If so, how? And if not, how come?
I'm still not sure what we're trying to accomplish here, guys.
What do you think?
I don't know what we're trying to accomplish.
Anybody help him out?
Well, first you guys started talking about, like, stuff like dinner peace and trying to get to sleep at night, and then all of a sudden everybody's changing from a person trying to get rest in this world to what the church is going to do to change everything. So first of all, it's sort of like how you can help yourself. All of a sudden it's how we're going to change the world. That's how I understood it.
I think Nicodemus, to take up that story, Nicodemus wanted to help himself.
Can I make an observation?
Sure.
I thought, now I realize this flies in the face of what a lot of people who are political activists, religious political activists feel. I thought our responsibility by Christ, among other things, was to be witnesses to his love in the world, not to go out and make the world become something we want to become. And it seems to me like a lot of political activism is moved, trying to force us to move in a direction of saying, we got it all figured out, and as soon as you guys get on board there. And I think that there's a good message in, I think it's, I'm not sure exactly what the book it is, but it says something to the effect of others may do as they want or wish, but as for me and my house, we shall worship the living God. It seems to suggest a sort of not trying to force everybody else into the same mold. And I see a lot of political activism as what it can easily become as a diversion to keep you from working on your own spiritual attunement. That if we spend all our time trying to pick the weeds out of our neighbor's flower garden, we won't have any time to pick the weeds out of our own. But there's got to be a real balance. And I'm not saying there is and shouldn't be a concern for the world things. But I think if we get all off into a sidetrack and thinking that's our commission as Christians to straighten out the world, I think myself we're on the wrong track.
A lot of what I've heard before tonight, I thought maybe was aimed at a world or a national situation. But what I've heard from both John and Karen tonight is local, very local, and that's what I hear coming, and is that in fact the case? Mm-hmm. Is that okay? That's different from what I thought before, and that should allay this fear if in fact you're talking about a local situation. Indeed, if you want to talk where Christ was, his world, if you wanted to find the world he went in, you could walk around given a couple of days.
I just wanted to say that your
your comments to me are very much on the point of what tonight's discussion is. I mean, you and I might have differences of opinion, but I think we got the same question. What should the church be doing? What is it doing? What kind of world are we living in? I mean, I did a little historically, but when I named four things, all of those were answers that people had at Jesus' time to your question. What should the church be doing? Should they run the world? Should it run away from the world? Should it concentrate on the salvation of people's souls and not worry about world hunger? And those groups are still here with the same answers, and we're saying, where are we on that question? That's a good question. The mission of the church is the question. So you probably said it better than... You probably stated your view better than I stated a kind of introduction to several possible views. So that's what we're talking about. As my friend in West Virginia says about me and my friends, you just think too much.
Well, I'll say one thing, thinking is dangerous.
And the task is difficult.
Yeah.
Sounds like we all need a good sauna. That clears up a lot of things.
It's a fit again. Well, when you keep talking about church and politics in the same breath, and I keep thinking of things I've learned at Beholden before, like Christ died for political, because of what he was doing politically and scaring all the people and that sort of thing. And then I was thinking, well, is it a religious act to go out and stand in front of a corn shop with a picket sign that says, corn causes rage? We finally ran the corn shop out of Parkland after 1 year of picketing, and I never once, while I was down there, thought of it as something I was doing because I was in the church, quote unquote. It wasn't part of my religion. But it certainly was part of the community, and now I look back on it, and I just, it was religion and the church and Christ acting. And we were trying to do everything we could to relieve ourselves of this thing in our community because of what we thought of what it was doing to our community. Those of us that picketed outside a certain line because we were requested to do that by the authorities, not because the law said we had to stay outside that line. We could have picketed on the guy's sidewalk. When he would come out and say things to us, really, you wouldn't believe, we didn't fight back. I mean, we didn't say back the things that we first thought of. We studied what we were doing. It was very interesting. But I was thinking the entire time until now that what I was doing was really a political thing. Political activism. I mean, we wanted that removed from our community. We knew it would make people lose jobs. We knew there'd be an empty storefront there when they were gone. We didn't know what would come in its place. It was still empty. These guys went to jail and got a big fat fine. And Pierce County is leading the country right now on what to do with pornography and the way that the police went in and they took only those things that were pornographically violent. They didn't just take everything in the store. They went through everything in the store and took only that which they knew would hold up in court. So all this time, it was always political. But I just felt all the time that people that read and use those materials are dangerous people. And they're dangerous to women and children physically. And it's dangerous to the men mentally, and I think it's dangerous to the men physically too, but maybe in a different way. I don't know how I got off
that. No, I would just like to comment on that. I for one think that is a living testimony or a living witness to the transformation and change within yourself. Mm-hmm. As I think John and Karen are both getting at, when you were doing that picketing, you thought of it only as political. But I dare say that you did it once, you would probably do it again.
Oh, you bet.
I mean, the power that to tell you by engaging in a political act that I don't suppose you got up that morning eager to do.
No.
It made you a very different person, very changed person, in a way a very, very powerful person.
Yeah.
Because you looked at things from a different way. And what I hear Karen and John saying is nuance. That's part of what this transformation of church is all about. And to speak to Keith's concern, remember John Cram's little diagram up here, I mean, gentle justice, and then the four corners here. Well, I think as a mirror. World.
If I get it wrong, I get it wrong. If I get it wrong, don't tell me.
Solitude and community. Yeah. Obviously, I live in one of these corners more than I live in another one of those corners. Obviously, from our conversation we've had today and last night, you live in a corner that's different from where I live. And what John and I think Karen are trying to do is help us connect those corners. And I would submit that as the church, that's a very needed action to help Christians, individual Christians, connect those corners of their life. Word with world, world with community, and community with solitude. Because I dare say, and as I examine my own life, and I examine the life of the students that I work with, they're very conscious of their individual selves and the pains that they have. But it's only when they realize how being students at the University of Chicago, one, carries with it its own mythology, which they fall victims to. I mean, I'm the best of the brightest, that's why I'm a student at the University of Chicago. Therefore, I have to study hard, therefore I have to disengage from everything, and also other measures that impact them. When they begin to realize that, then they begin to grow as individuals. They become connected with one another, and they begin to affirm one another. They begin to affirm friendship. So I'm simply suggesting that what I want from John Schramm and what I get from my wife, and what I think you get from John Schramm, not going to add that you get it from my wife, is that those four corners are kept, at least attempt to be connected this week. And that's the transition. That's the transformation. Or as Walter Wink, one of my professors at Union Seminary, says, Bible study is not for information. And I'm glad you said you don't like Bible studies anymore. But what Bible study is really is for transformation. That we become different individuals, and that we become connected or coupled with one another. And not just people on the left coupled with one another, but people on the left, people in the middle, and people in the right. And I think that's one of the dangers that we have in the church right now, is that we have so many actions coming from either the left or the right that those who see the church as a viable force can pit those off against one another too. And what I would like to see, and I think, now you spoke to it very eloquently, I doubt if every person on that picket line was a Republican. I doubt that every person was a Democrat. I doubt that every person was rich, but they were a mix of people. And I kind of hear that's what you're trying to get at, too. How can that mix that separates us, that if you want, Caesar uses to pit us against each other, so we walk out of worship services or we have a huff or we feel good about them, how can that cease to be used to pit us against one another so that we can be this community that has people who live in solitude, who study the word, that are engaged in the world. So, having that into that little homily,
I'd like to try something, and you certainly don't have to answer, but I'd like to go back to the worship service, which had a lot of feeling at the beginning, and see whether or not that relates to our topic. For instance, the people who were unhappy with the worship service, and I think it was the majority, is that that it made the transitions too dramatic, that we're really not in that bad a shape, or that it made, if we exorcised Satan and didn't name certain corporations, then it would have been religious, but then we got into politics. I think that may be a way that we get at part of what we're talking about tonight, mm-hmm. and it would be real, because there were mixed feelings about the service. Would you? I'm looking at you because you were the first one, but lots of people held up their hand in both ways. If people would be willing to share that, I think we might be on the topic tonight.
Well, I'm not for religion.
Yeah, I know.
I think the format of the exorcism was especially poor for a Vespers type presentation. I don't.
Okay.
I've been to Holden several times. I think you've fallen into a mode where you're deliberately trying to shock us or cram something down our throats. I think in Vespers it should be more neutral. The workshops and seminars are fine. I come to them to get exposed to different points of feeling. That's good. That's what I've gone to. Several of them that I've been very enlightened by some, and perhaps more polarized by others, but I primarily first object to the worship service just kind of flippantly or callously bringing up the whole exorcism thing as part of the worship. As a Christian, I didn't get much of a Christian content out of the, I guess, the exorcism format. Secondly, I guess I make a very good living in business. That's fine. All of us in this room probably do, mm-hmm. or the clergy that we support with our offerings. And you need us, of course. Seriously.
That's true.
So that's who votes on the raises every year. I would like to see it dealt with more generally. I don't think you should name names. I think we know who makes cars and we know who makes chemicals. And I was looking for a case on the paper. I had interest in saying, well, why did you keep calling out those? That was a little, I think you were somehow singling those out for a special punishment. General Motors cars are, General Motors is awful, but Chrysler is the eye of COVID because he does a statute of abuse. Dow has gotten to the point where they can run good commercials on TV again. You've got a whole new generation that doesn't remember Dow. You think Dow, makes people happy. That was just getting a little too close. I know about acid rain, I know about pollution, oil, I know all those problems, but it was that type of a thing.
It sounds to me like for you it was not a substantive issue that we're talking about here. It was format, style, more than substance, or the place, Vespers instead of the workshop.
Or was it also the putting things in two different camps? There was the left and the right side of the litany. Was it that too that bothered you? Or
I wasn't going to read the right side, but you were on the left. Yeah.
That some are all the good, these are all the good over here, and these are all the bad over here. Did you get that kind of?
Oh, well, that's the way it was. That's the way it was done.
About 5 years ago, I guess it's 42, I went to a 4-day seminar with Scott Peck on the book he wrote after the Road Less Traveled called The People of the Lie. And I don't know how many have read that book, but the workshop was a real example, I don't know the right words for me. It was an expression of how to cope with evil. It was for pastors and therapists and anybody in helping professions. And it was started out with an exorcism. And it was real invaluable. People were so agitated, including myself, because he talked about a 5-day treatment of a client he had that he had worked with for 3 years, and nothing made a difference. She had 7 personalities. And finally, through the advice of a Catholic priest, he formed a team. He was not a Christian at the time. He formed a team of 7 people representing different denominations to pray for exorcism for this woman. At the end of 5 days, he has a little thing on a video. She had 1 personality. and it was a lot of it dealing with the world of the demonic, which is extremely unpopular in the world of professional therapy and of my own ministers. And yet, what the main portrayal of what he was saying was evil was all the ways that we use control. And especially within the church, in the way that we will not own that we have a dark side, and we will not own how we manipulate and get our way and use power over each other, and that was one of the most dangerous forms of evil. And I was thinking, I liked the service very much. What I didn't like was that the people laughed. There was laughing during the little tinkling of the bell, and even the woman doing it laughed a little bit or smiled, and that troubled me, because to me, we are so under the control of all those things that were named that we don't even realize it anymore. And I don't know that I would call them demons exactly, except they are, I do call them forms of evil. And since I went to that workshop, we have turned over every stone in our family and done a lot of confrontation of a lot of things that we do, and examined habits, examined forms of entertainment, watched what we watch on TV and what we not watch anymore, things that we buy. And a lot of that's come from Holden Village. And so anyway, I liked it.
The reason that I said I wanted to say I felt both ways about it was just that it scares me. It scares me to talk about the demons and I know that they're there, and we left one of the Episcopal churches that we used to attend because we were possessed. Absolutely terrifying. But when you finally come to your right mind, all we could do was flee, which is what we did. It was left that church. And it took about a year for me to really recover. I don't think it bothered Bill that much. But it was very divisive in our family. And so we fled the demons from in the church. And I used to think that whole church needed to be exorcised. But it's very scary to me to talk about it.
I guess what I liked about it was the context of scripture. What I thought was an opening hymn of gratitude and thankfulness, and then a closing tremendous hymn of praise. And I like the context for the exorcism.
Yeah, some of what this gentleman was saying, I agree with. I felt that it was too judgmental for the whole congregation. That was someone else's perception. Although I did not disagree with any one of them that was on there, in a general sense, I felt it was too judgmental and felt it lacked a lot of grace that I like to see in a service.
But I
sort of
like
that
it was.
Did or didn't? I'm sorry.
I didn't. I see this. Are these vespers like church services for praising God? I mean, because tonight it didn't seem like we were doing it. We were talking about demons and stuff like that. We were praising God. It was all demons talking about stuff like that.
One of the things that I have a little difficulty with is the whole concept of demonology, that anything that has to do with demons has to do with the devil, and therefore is evil. I see this in we work with the mentally ill folks who are on the streets. At the time of Jesus and in history, very often these people were seen as being filled with evil, with the demons, and they should be exorcised. These are sick people, and I think that if we look at our society today with the pollutants and everything else, we see the result of a sickness within our society, and I have difficulty calling it evil or of the demons or belonging to the devil. I believe that it's more sickness, and we need to move from sickness to wellness. And I think that kind of terminology is helpful for me.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have kind of a sideways, let's just go with it. The thing that I really liked about it was that I was, you know, it wasn't, didn't have anything to do with the demon part. It just had to do with the fact that I could connect my real interest and care for the earth and ecology with Christianity, and when that, those things are, you know, are being affirmed, it's like within this Christian context, it affirms my interest in the earth. Then I'm excited, so I was excited for that. But then I just been listening to John talk about sense of humor and not taking ourselves too seriously. So I guess I was one of the ones that was sort of laughing over the demon stuff, because I mean, it didn't, it, you know, she kind of made a, you know, she did an explanation on the thing and said, you know, don't take it so literally and don't take it so seriously and don't, you know, you can mean this and that. And so to me, you know, it was just, I guess I covered my feelings of, oh, this is spooky, you know, this is like something that witches do, you know, those kinds of things were just, ah, that's funny, we're gonna sell bells, you know, and it, that was just a little part of the overall, gee, it's really good to be, you know, thinking about the earth, and to have those things affirmed in the religious context.
Might it be that those who did not care for it found neither enough gentleness nor enough justice in exactly the way it was done?
I talked to the gentleman that left the service, one of the first ones in the service, and he basically was a very conservative pastor himself, of course. And I think it finally got to him, the fact that all he's heard up here for a week is a lot of the controversial stuff, whether it's Nicaragua or gay rights or feminism or whatever, and he doesn't see the balance. He's very disappointed that there's not some sort of balance, and that he's disappointed that there isn't more of the traditional word of God or the spirituality from that aspect. He is not very happy about going back and having not much to say good about Golden Village. I've been up here many times. I was up here in 67, 68. I was in 68, Willie Hirschfeld was here, causing the same sort of controversial things. This, the forum tonight is very mild compared to one night he was here. But I did not like the service tonight. Vespers is where you have, where everybody in the building comes together. So you feel like you're in a captive audience in a sense. You shouldn't leave, right? Mm-hmm. I did not repeat the responses on the demon thing. I did not want to do that. I thought that was wrong. Now, that's my personal feeling. I didn't, the whole day has been a little bit of a bummer for me on some of the lectures. Certain things were said, and I didn't appreciate them. I don't think it should have been said in the context that they were. I didn't see that they added to the lecture sometimes. And so this is probably the worst day at Hope that I've ever been at. And I think part of the discussion with the person left kind of gets a little bit, yeah. That's, it's unfortunate, I think, that some of these happen tonight.
I found it so exciting because it was shocking, and it's too bad that we have to be shocked. And I think so often we Lutherans are so used to such niceness in our church services, and I mean, God all knows all that stuff that we said. What's wrong with talking about it in church? What's not? What's wrong with proclaiming this is evil? And we are part of it. This is God's world, His earth, and it doesn't belong to Him. And it's the shocking things that we remember. And so you'll probably remember this day.
Well, I told a gentleman from South Dakota that they use this. They try to get you to think about that sort of thing. But you still are lacking the balance. This week doesn't have any balance on the total picture as far as I'm concerned.
It's past 10 o'clock. We customarily end at 10. One of the things that Luther said someplace in terms of definition of the church is that where the word is preached, where it's heard, where it's discussed by the hearers, and where it's lived out. It seems to me that we've done that tonight. That's the community, the difficulty that we have in living in community, it seems to me, has bubbled to the surface tonight. I hope we sleep well.
I think I'll go out and buy a new Honda. I'll feel real good about it.
Okay. If I can have a first
drive that old devil to the Lake Chelan.
So we thank you for your bubbling ups, and we'll see you in the morning.